Welcome to another episode of I Talk Movies. I'm your moderator, Carolina Benetti, and we're interviewing today director Zara Hayes.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talk's I Talk Movies.
Hi guys, thank you so much for joining us today. We're sitting here today with Zara Hayes, and we are going to talk all about her brand new movie, Palms, starring Diane Keaton. And to take it away, we're going to preview the trailer for you now.
Got everything you could ever need. Over 100 clubs. Now what brings you to Sun Springs?
Oh, I'm just here to die.
Uh-huh.
Hi. Moving in.
I was hoping you'd be a man.
There's not enough erections around here as it is.
What's this? You were a cheerleader.
My mother was very sick, so I quit the team.
Maybe you should give it another shot.
We want to start a cheerleading club.
Who will you be cheering for?
Ourselves.
Show us what you've got.
Woo! She's great. I always did want to be a cheerleader. I'd ask my husband. What'd he say? Over my dead body.
That was fast. A little too fast, if you ask me.
See, I practice. A competition. Mm-hmm. Let's sign up. We could do with a little help.
We want you to be our choreographer.
The oldest category is 18 plus.
We're 18 plus. 18 plus 50.
I'm not going to lie to you. It's going to be a lot tougher than I thought.
When I jump too much, I get dizzy.
I had my knee replaced.
Did I mention I had chlamydia?
Yeah, you did, along with a shocking amount of other information.
Martha, what about you?
Me? No, I'm fine. I'm fit as a fiddle.
Why didn't you tell me?
I'm dying.
You were dying yesterday, and you're gonna be dying next week. In the meantime, you should be dancing your ass off.
You are going to humiliate yourself!
I can't do this!
We're all so worried about what everyone else is thinking, when of course the only thing that really matters is what we think of ourselves.
Break a hip.
Get pregnant.
I always wanted to date a cheerleader.
I am here. I am here.
Now I know you're scared. You're scared too.
But there's someone I'd rather go out there with.
I've never had a grandma before, and now it's like I have eight.
You're one of us now, except with higher boobies.
And that was a look at Palms. Hello, Zara. How are you today?
I'm well, thank you.
I want to congratulate you. I saw on IMDb you guys are the number four top grossing movie in the US and Canada.
Yes, we are indeed.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
And now, that's pretty impressive also because a lot of really big studio movies have so many more screens. Yeah. So to come in at number four with more of a limited engagement is also amazing.
Yeah, and also I think, you know, Avengers is sort of the beast that that is hard to kind of
it's a cash
with.
Cow.
I mean, it's just so huge, and the reach, and Pikachu is also a huge movie. So I think it's like when you're comparing this sort of film to those kind of blockbusters, that's, you know, that's where you've
you're been, killing you know. It. Because in all intents and purposes, when you have like 200, 400 million dollar movies, to do Palms and have it come out at number four, that's a blockbuster in its own right.
Right, yeah. And I think it's serving, you know, obviously, like, it's serving a very different audience to those movies. But to sort of have a voice in the midst of all of that power, muscle power that those movies have is really difficult.
And now for people who don't know and they're interested in seeing the movie, which came out May 10th, so you guys can run out and watch it now. How did this story come about for you?
Well, you know, the movie tells the story of a woman who sets up a cheerleading club in a retirement community. And I think if I'd just pitched that as a movie idea, people might have been like, that seems a bit surreal or a little bit absurd. But the truth is that this is a real thing that women across America in their 60s and 70s and 80s in some cases have set up cheerleading squads all across the country. And I came across it about 5 years ago, when I was sort of living in the UK and was thinking of making a documentary about cheerleading and came across these images and just thought, wow, what is this? I need to know more. Like, I need to make a film about this.
Wait, so are they really competing as well, like the women in the movie, or is it just like within their community?
So it varies, but they definitely perform. You know, there's teams that I spoke to in Arizona who they perform at the Sun Bowl parade every year. They perform at local football matches, college football matches, grocery store performances, that kind of thing. And some women are just literally doing it as a kind of way to keep fit and get together. But a lot of them are performing.
It's amazing.
In fact, one of the things that kind of moved me most was when I was researching it, I came across these videos of women who'd gone into a high school and done a performance. And to see the young people's reaction to the older cheerleaders was kind of really fascinating and kind of heartwarming.
Awesome. You can do anything you want if you set your mind to it. It's kind of the moral of the story.
Yeah, it is. And more than that, I think it's that you don't really sort of don't take on people's preconceptions about what is and isn't okay for an older woman. And just do what you want to do and don't wait for someone's approval, which is the whole message of it, actually.
I love that. I feel like women everywhere could take that message.
Totally, of all ages, right?
Absolutely.
But I feel like women of that age have probably got to a stage where like they've spent their whole lives being told what to do. You know, they lived through like
the 60s
and all the social changes. A lot of them were probably, young teens in the 50s, which then they had the 60s happen. And then the 80s, where it's like there's another set of rules for what you can and can't do. And now I think they're probably at a point in their life where they're just like free to sort of be what they want to be, and if a cheerleader is the thing that gets them going, then good for them.
But now I love that this topic also came to you, because in the UK, for those of you who may or may not know, the UK doesn't have cheerleaders. You guys don't really do that in Europe.
Not at all, no. And actually there are a few teams now, but it's because of the American influence. But when I was growing up, cheerleading was this quintessentially American thing that you knew about through movies and TV and was kind of glamorous as a result.
No, it's not. It's really painful. People break things all the time.
Right. Absolutely. Because then when I started looking into it, it's like, it's so athletic and like it's so demanding as a sport. And it's changed so much over the years as well. When I was researching into it, I also found out that cheerleading actually originally was a male thing. It was for men. Originally, which I didn't know.
So is gymnastics.
Right.
We showed them. So the story came about, and then you found out for this one article that it was a thing and it was an older community. But then when you dug into it, you found out that there's loads of them.
Yeah.
So what made you take that idea and turn it into the story about a woman really coming into her own? Because over the arc of the movie, we do get to see Diane Keaton's character change so much.
Yeah. I think the marriage of the kind of the character with the story was something that just clicked for us. And just it felt to me like, you know, to make a movie about a retirement community and not have kind of someone dealing with the end stages of life felt disingenuous, because I think often these movies, like if the few that are made about older people, are kind of just peddling like complete fantasies. And I kind of wanted to try and do something that blended more of the reality of the situation in with it. And I also love the idea of a character like Diane Keaton plays this woman who is the last person you would expect to want to be a cheerleader. At the beginning of the movie, she's not kind of peppy and sort of, you know, team spirited and kind of like looking to make girlfriends. She's the opposite of that. And I found that really exciting, because the thing that kind of mirrors my journey with it, which is like cheerleading has always been a bit of a kind of funny thing for me, because on the one hand, it's amazing achievement and it's kind of beautiful to watch. But on the other hand, like the symbolism of like women dancing on the sidelines for men is a bit of a kind of problem to me. And so but then when I saw these women doing it and doing it on their own terms, I was completely amazed by it and completely won over by it. And so I kind of wanted to reflect that somehow in the movie. And I like the idea that, you know, that often I think at the end of life, like the things that are most meaningful to you are in a way the most seemingly frivolous things to other people. And I read this really interesting book by this nurse who'd nursed people on their deathbeds. And the things that they regret, she published this thing called Top Regrets of the Dying.
Oh.
And like, the things that people regret are often the smaller kind of... They've come to terms with the bigger decisions in their life, like the job they didn't take, or the move they didn't make, or the person they, you know, they didn't get back together with. But then something like this, it seems so ridiculous that this would be the thing that would haunt you, that you didn't get the chance to be a cheerleader at high school. But it rings true to me in terms of the research that I did about, you know, people's high school experiences are so kind of, in a way, emblazoned onto people's souls. I think, you know, you don't ever get over your who you were at high school.
Oh, and interesting.
I think you know, what the experiences you have as a teenager are really visceral still. Like, I can still remember being 14 and the things that happened to me, and no matter what I do in my life, like, I'll never not feel in some way like I'm still that 14-year-old. And I think that's true of, like, a lot of people.
Yeah, I could see that. I feel like, true, that's like where the saying comes for people that, like, hold on to their past glory or the glory days, or why that's become such a thing, because so many people do look back to, like, high school and maybe college, like, yeah, those, like, four totally. Years. Because you guys do it a bit different in the UK for schooling, right? Like, we have our university/college, it's just, the name is just, like, different based on prestige. Like, right. A university is more top tier than a college, but it's the same, the 4 year. But you guys do it differently over in the UK, right?
Well, or you have school till you're 18, and then you go to university from 18. And then sort of the quickest version is 3 years to get an undergraduate degree, which I think it's 4 years in the States. But they're all called universities. But, yeah, totally, that time in your life is... For a lot of people, though, it's kind of missed opportunity, and it was not being quite what they wanted to be. And what I found in talking to all these women who have set up cheerleading teams, which I found really very interesting, is that the overwhelming majority of them were not cheerleaders at high school.
Mm-hmm.
So they were kind of, it wasn't that they were going back to their glory days. It was that they were kind of creating something for themselves that they missed out on for whatever reason. Often because they were too shy to put themselves forward, or they didn't think they were the right kind of girl. They didn't think they were pretty enough.
There's a lot of stereotypes.
Yeah. And so that's why I found it empowering, because I thought, these people, like, being a cheerleader when you're at high school in the 60s or 70s was the thing that you could do as a woman. Like, you know, there weren't many sporting opportunities going on. So, like, that's what you, if you wanted to be part of something, that was the pinnacle. And, but then it excluded so many people for these arbitrary reasons to do with what they looked like or how popular they were or whatever. And so now I think the idea that they kind of always wanted to do that secretly and then in their later life have found the confidence to do it is a very beautiful thing.
That is. It's a beautiful sentiment, too. And now for making the film, how hard was it to bring this idea from a seed of an idea to fruition, to what we get to enjoy now in theaters?
Well, it's been a 5-year journey.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Since that seed.
Did it start with the script, or did it start with the story that you read?
It started with me finding out about this idea and the fact that it is real, and then thinking, okay, I want to make a movie about it. And I initially thought I'd make a documentary. And then when I researched it more, I thought, no, this should be on a bigger platform. This should be told on a bigger scale. So I was thinking about a fictional story, and I started to put together some elements of a story, worked with a screenwriter to get a script together, and then took that to producers. So that was kind of, you know, probably about 4 years ago.
How long did it take to write the screenplay once you had the idea for the story in place?
I'm trying to remember. It was pretty quick. Like, I think we did it in about 6 months.
Oh, wow.
The first draft.
Yeah.
Maybe 9.
How many drafts did you end up going through?
Oh, my goodness. There were so many drafts. Because every time something, you know, once Diane Keaton got on board, we did another 3 or 4 drafts. And then you have production drafts when you actually know where you're shooting it. Because originally... I'd set it in Arizona, which is where the first team that I contacted were, the Sun City Palms, who are awesome kind of...
I love the name, the Sun City Palms.
Yeah, they're really great. You should look them up. They're wonderful. And they're one of the original kind of, like, you know, retirement community cheerleading clubs. And
I love that it wasn't just them, that it's like a club now. Like, yeah. It's something people go there and join. And I love that.
Totally. But they, I originally set it in Arizona for that reason. Mm-hmm. And then because of production reasons, we ended up going to Georgia, which completely changed the whole, you know, it's a different story if you're going to the South. And so we adjusted it for that. And it went through so many iterations. I couldn't even tell you how many actual drafts there were.
But that's pretty normal. That's the thing most people don't know, is like most films, the completion that you see is a series of revisions and drafts and changes.
Oh, completely. But it's also, I think of it as like a living thing, because even during production, I mean, there were rewrites happening overnight and like over the weekends, because locations change, especially when you're working on a smaller budget film, which is what this was. You don't have the luxury of like weather insurance or all of these kind of practical things that come in and bear down, or, you know, you can't just have your pick of locations. And so it inherently changes depending on what's available and what's practical. And so you have to be nimble and like willing to, you have to kind of know, okay, well, this can change and it won't affect the heart of it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas this stuff, I need to fight to protect this. But yeah, it was constantly being written and rewritten. And then, of course, when you get actors in the mix, and if you're a director who wants that kind of interaction, which I did, that's also brings changes and kind of new ideas. And
because it's the actor's point of view about their character, which, good on you, that's so collaborative. And I find that that's something that female directors have much more than male directors, is a more collaborative approach. I'm not saying that male directors don't have collaborative approaches, to clarify, but I find that like 99% of women, I just hear like female directors so collaborative in like their approach with the actors and how they work together.
Yeah, I mean, I can't speak to what it's like, the gender part of it, but I do think that there is a kind of there are different ways of going about this whole directing business, and my view is always that collaboration brings the best results, because why be afraid of kind of letting other people in who have ideas and have very strong takes on their characters and their kind of journey. And, you know, your job is to kind of shepherd all of that. But it's a really subjective thing. I know some people are like, you know, the script is a Bible and that is it. And it's sacrosanct and you can't change a word of it. I don't think I'll ever feel like that about any script that I direct. You know.
Well, good to know. And then also, how long did you guys film? How long did it take to actually complete the movie once you started rolling?
We had 29 days, but we lost one of them, maybe one and a half even, to weather.
Oh,
which was really frustrating. Don't film in Georgia in the summer if you can avoid it. but it was pretty tight, and there were shorter days because of lots of reasons. But so it was to get through that much material in the time, it was a pretty big undertaking.
And then from the director's chair as well, what were challenges that you found that might have even surprised you doing this film in Georgia? How was that?
Well, I think that specifically in relation to Georgia, and I don't know how interesting this is for people, but they are set up to basically do the really huge budget studio movies.
Mm-hmm.
And because the tax credit that producers get is so great, there's a thriving culture and industry of like top-notch professionals, crew, and like everybody is completely at the top of their game, which is wonderful. But as a tiny movie trying to kind of fit yourself into that culture, because they are so over subscribed really, every location, every accommodation, every office you look at, they're not really into kind of like doing you a deal for a small movie.
Oh, got it. Yeah.
Because they don't need to, because they've got, you know, the Marvel movies are all filming there.
The Walking Dead.
Yeah.
Of, like,
they just don't need a tiny indie movie. And so that's difficult. And to kind of get the loyalty from the crew and things like that, because you're not, because you're small, yeah. You know, you're just competing with a completely different level of production. We did manage to find like amazing crew, and I loved everybody we worked with, but it was a challenge, I've got to say. And then the weather there is in the summer, I mean, literally in the morning. Hot. Well, it's hot, and we're dancing with older women, which is a kind of challenge in itself. But they were incredible, and their stamina was great. But we had, you know, extras fainting and things like that because of the heat. Like, it was it was really relentless. But
it's also the humidity, I feel. It just, like, presses in on you.
Yeah, and it's also just the light isn't beautiful, frankly, you know. I would not choose to go there again at that time of year.
So if you could go back, one thing you could change is location.
But I couldn't have had the movie made. That's the problem. You know, that this is the sort of dilemma that you face, isn't it, as a filmmaker? It's like there is no way that creatively, in terms of the light, the challenges of like in the morning, it would be bright, bright sunlight, so blazing that, you know, you can't really shoot anything pretty because the sun is so high. And then in the afternoon, there'd be these thunder and lightning storms that would stop production for 2 hours.
Man.
And you have to stop if there's a lightning strike within 3 miles of your set or whatever it is with the generator. But then trying to shoot a scene that has continuity across that day, can you imagine how difficult that is?
No.
And it's not like in the best case scenario, the light is what you wanted anyway. So there were a lot of amazing things about working in Georgia, for sure. And the people, and like I said, the talent of the people and the kind of the friendliness of the place overall. And, you know, I had a great experience, but frankly, like, I wouldn't.
The sun and the weather.
It's just too much at that time of year. You know, it's just really not a pleasant experience.
Hey, that's true, though. But for every filmmaker that's listening to this, if they're thinking about doing a film and they're self-financing or they're doing something, stuff like that's really, really important to know.
It is important to know. But at the same time, you know, I look back and it's like, correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm not obviously the producer, but I think the tax break is 30% of the entire budget of the film.
Oh, wow.
And it's on everybody's salary, not just the people who work in Georgia. So, like, all the actors, the directors, the producers, everybody. So it's like, we couldn't have made this film. We just couldn't have done it.
That's had
we
not done it there. It's unbeatable, break.
Yeah. But, of course, now there's all this debate about what's going on with Georgia and the
legislation politics.
And the politics. So that's a whole other realm that would be very interesting to see how it plays out. Because the industry is not kind of loyal. It's driven by the finances, right?
Yeah.
So that, you know, if another state came and said, hey,
we can do it.
We can do that too.
We'd be like, cool, we're going to go there. And guess what? Politics aren't involved. Way better for us.
I'm kind of waiting for the next state to put
New Mexico had a really good one for a long time. I don't know where they messed up. It was close. I feel like all the actors were happy because you'd come home on the weekend if you weren't shooting.
I don't know what happened there.
Georgia's a drag. Like, if you live in LA, it, like, not in a bad way, but it's a drag if you want to see your family and everybody's here. It's a lot to take on.
Well, it is a lot. I mean, I flew to the prep from the UK, and the flight from London is easier than getting from LA to Atlanta.
I believe that.
It's like so easy, and it was quicker, and, you know, and I don't know. It just, you know, they've got amazing studios there now as well, though, with Pinewood and everything.
They built them because of Marvel.
Yeah, built them on the back of that, and I can't see it kind of disappearing quickly, but with this political situation now, I'll be very interested to see what happens.
I mean, Netflix is moving into New York City. They're building up. So is it Netflix or Amazon? Netflix, right? I think it's Netflix.
I think it's Netflix, yeah.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Just throw it in the comments. I'll apologize.
But I don't know what happened with New Mexico and why they... But I think that it's... Because a lot of people in-state don't like giving the film industry such breaks. They don't think it, like, helps in the long term.
I think it helps so much with the economy.
I mean, I think Georgia has been transformed by it. But
absolutely.
And just to say as well, by the way, like, lots of people I know have shot at different times of year, and in Savannah and stuff, it's a different story. So I think like it's also where in Georgia you shoot.
Oh, where in Georgia were you shooting?
We were within the Atlanta area, so okay. We were dealing with like crazy traffic every day and the logistics of that as well. So you take 2 hours off your work day for traffic mm-hmm. as well, because the clock starts when everybody leaves their base, right?
Mm-hmm.
And no location was less than a 45-minute drive away from wherever everyone was staying. So that, you know, there are a lot of kind of logistical stuff that I wasn't really aware of and became very aware of in the process of making it.
You have to be like a magician to be a director, I feel, because if something goes wrong, you have to make it right. You have to figure it out on the fly. But
I think it's just about being in the moment and thinking on your feet. And that's something that I really, really loved, actually. And I thrive on that. You know, my background is in documentary, and mm-hmm. there's no more kind of realm in which you need to be in responsive to the moment than documentary. And I think that training that I've had in that really put me in a position where, you know, not I didn't get that fazed by even these crazy things that would happen, like where the weather would just, we'd shot 3/4 of a scene and then with very little warning the rain would just start and you're just like, okay, so how are we going to deal with this? And so, but even just things, the unexpected crops up all the time, right? That's life. And actors sort of not, you know, feeling a completely different way today than they were yesterday or, you know, whatever, like just things happen. And I think your job is to sort of do the best you can, like in the moment, knowing what you want in the end
mm-hmm.
and kind of never losing sight of the bigger picture of what you need and want, but not getting derailed by these things, because you can't have the perfect, unless you have unlimited time and money, which like I don't know anyone who has apart from who can reshoot a whole movie basically. But unless you do, like you have to kind of just kind of make the best and be okay with that and kind of see yeah. that as part of the journey and see it as like this living, breathing thing, which I find kind of more weirdly, I find that more creative and exciting than sort of imposing this very strict, stringent kind of set of conditions that you're setting yourself up for failure basically yeah. with. And you're never going to be surprised by reality and the magic that can actually happen in the room. And there are a number of moments in Palms that happened organically that I'm so happy with.
You can see that in the movie. It feels very organic and lifelike and like you're just dropping into a slice of life for these women.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah, I really wanted to capture that because I felt like, you know, when you're hanging out with a group of friends, like there's a scene in the bowling alley where they're just all kind of like celebrating and kind of enjoying each other's company, and it's like, how do you capture that feeling of like being out with your friends? And there's a organic lifelike quality that I wanted to try and get that comes from just giving a bit of freedom and a bit of air to what's going on and letting these amazing actors who I got the privilege of working with do their thing, you know, and kind of drawing upon their talents.
And speaking of the actors, I wanted to talk a bit about casting. So did you always have Diane Keaton in mind for the lead, and how involved were you in the casting process?
Oh, I mean, all of the casting came through me. I don't know how you could direct a film if you weren't in the one leading the casting. I mean, obviously you have to, because to me that's everything, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, clearly you have to work in collaboration with whoever's producing and financing it, because you can't just be like, I want this person. But no one was objecting to the idea of Diane Keaton. Everybody was very much, yes, fantasy kind of league casting if we could get her. And she was someone who, like this Martha character who she plays, there is something about her that is, it's hard to explain, but she sort of starts off as this kind of slightly sardonic, sarcastic woman who's kind of doesn't seem to be very open.
A little bit curmudgeonly,
yeah. And then kind of by the end is kind of, you know, has blossomed and opened up in this most beautiful way and kind of like is telling everybody she loves them and kind of has like forged connections with people, basically. And to see someone go on that journey is... Yeah, it's a really a wonderful thing, and I wanted somebody who, I just felt like she would embody that journey so well. And we sent the script to her, and she liked it, and we started talking. And you know, I think her performance is really special and really nuanced in this film. I really do. I think what she manages to kind of convey within a very simple story, in a way, the complexities and the layers are really there, in terms of the emotional experience of this woman who is kind of starts by, you know, being ready to kind of face death and stare it in the face and be brave, but is kind of, as a result, maybe tunnel visioned and blinkered, mm-hmm. About her approach, and is being strong, but is also kind of closed off, to in the end kind of doing this very, you know, unexpected and idiosyncratic thing that ends up with her making all these new connections and being derailed in the most wonderful way.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of like, it's quite a journey to go on in 90 minutes.
It's delightful. I truly enjoyed the film. And for the more technical listeners, I want to talk a bit about the cameras that mm-hmm. you used and why you decided to use them. I don't know that much about cameras, so please educate us as we.
So the DP I worked with was Tim Orr, mm-hmm. who is a really interesting and talented man, because he has managed to kind of like make this career for himself in the US.
And you've worked with him before?
I've never worked with him before.
Oh, it's first time.
But okay. I'd admired his work. And my thing is that I've mainly worked with UK-based DPs before. So, you know, on our budget, it was kind of not that much of an option to be able to bring someone. So I had to kind of find someone new. And Tim, I mean, thank goodness that he said yes to our project, because he has this really unique experience in that he has gone between doing, like, he shot all of David Gordon Green's films, so like Pineapple Express and like a lot of kind of really gritty stuff with him in the beginning, and then he also has shot kind of studio comedies across his life. And but then he's also done these beautiful dramas like Ziva Zachariah. Mm-hmm. So he has this kind of breadth of experience that isn't just like he's always doing studio comedies that look a certain way, but nor is he someone who doesn't know how to kind of pull those strings and make that work. And so I thought he could bring something quite unique maybe to the look of it. And we worked together. We talked about shooting on film. And truthfully, you know, these women at this age, the softness of film would have been amazing for that aspect of it. But for the production challenges that we faced on our budget, it just kind of didn't feel realistic. And so we went with the Alexa okay. as the camera, which I've shot with multiple times in documentary. And I really love the Alexa. I think it performs very well in the situations that we wanted to mm-hmm. to capture, and the colors are beautiful on it. And so we worked together, and then we decided to shoot with older lenses on the Alexa to try and soften the image slightly, because this
what do you mean by older lenses?
Like lenses literally from the 60s and 70s.
Oh, okay.
So like you kind of attach those to like a new camera, and it's
that's so cool, because that's back when they shot all in film.
Exactly. And so they often like they have a bit of diffusion to them naturally, and also they have some flaws in them sometimes that are kind of you know, the focus isn't entirely consistent and perfect, and that sounds bad, but I don't mean it like that. I just mean it gives the kind of image a kind of a bit more of an organic feel.
I was going to say more realism, maybe,
yeah,
like the way you see people in real life.
Yes and no. I mean, the thing is that the problem I have with this kind of like, you can shoot it in 4K, you can shoot it in 5K, and you just keep going and
nobody
going and
needs
going
to see inside my pores, yeah, like that. Nobody.
I don't think it's beautiful, and I don't think anybody really wants to mm-mm. see that on a big screen, and it's kind of like, it's too much. And I knew that, especially with these, you know, with older women dancing and stuff, I just kind of wanted to mitigate the kind of the 4K-ness of it as much as we could. Mm-hmm. And so we found these lenses that we work with. And
wait, so then did the Alexa shoot in 4K?
Yeah.
Well, but then you did the lenses.
The 4K is the recording, like, it's the...
I don't know these things.
So, yeah, you're basically recording the data, essentially. And Alexa technically isn't 4K, which people get very het up about. It's actually like a few pixels short of 4K. But for all intents and purposes, it is 4K.
Okay.
Although Netflix won't let you shoot anything on Alexa because it's technically not true 4K, which is a whole other conversation. But it's almost 4K. It's basically 4K to the human eye, can't tell any difference. But that's the kind of like the data that you have in the image that you've shot. But how you capture the image comes through the lens, obviously. So you're kind of essentially, you're filtering what you're putting down into the 4K information. That makes sense?
No, it absolutely makes sense. And I know all the tech heads that are watching are like, yes, we know all about this.
Yeah, no, and it's a thing that people have been doing to sort of, to try and make these cameras a little bit sort of feel a bit softer and have a different quality to them, because it can just I don't find it beautiful when things are so super high definition, but so that's what we did basically. And then we tried to find an approach to the lighting, which is the biggest thing with something like this. Like, you've often got scenes where there are eight women, all different skin tones, all different heights, and you want them all to look as great as they can whilst it still feels real. And I didn't want it to feel unreal and overlit like a studio comedy. So I tried to kind of work with Tim, and we tried to give it a really natural feel. And I think, I think he achieved that really well in what he did with the lighting. And that sort of stuff is like really hard to get right and never gets kind of the praise it deserves. I think, in terms of people sort of see a movie that's kind of all natural lighting and all shot of magic hour, and they're just like, oh, it's so beautiful and cinematic. And I actually think, the respect for kind of lighting a scene, an interior scene with seven characters, all women over a certain age, and making it look beautiful is kind of like massively underappreciated in our industry. So, yeah.
Well, we're giving it love right now.
Give it the love, yeah.
And so as we're talking about projects and lighting, I want to talk about what you might be working on next. Because for people who aren't aware, you were also the documentary filmmaker behind The Battle of the Sexes.
Yes.
Not the Emma Stone movie, the actual documentary with Billie Jean.
Yeah.
And also you did one with Nat Geo on, was it Primates?
On Diane Fossey.
Yeah, Diane Fossey.
I made a mini-series for them about Diane Fossey. So, yeah, I mean, all of those, this project and those two, I guess they all kind of have women, female protagonists, heroic female protagonists, I would say. I think that Martha, Diane's character, is a hero, or a shiro, as Billie Jean King would say. And I think that I'm definitely attracted to that, but I don't want to be limited to that either. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an interesting thing with like female directors, how it's sort of you're told the kind of stories you're allowed to tell as well. That said, I think there is such a wealth of female stories that just haven't been told, that there's a gold mine out there of kind of stories that, we've seen the male version of it a million times, and that, we can, if we sort of look at the female perspective, there's a whole new aspect to this story that opens up something new. So that's the kind of thing that I'm looking at next. There is another true story that I'm pursuing that is about women who kind of change the world.
Is it a documentary or no, can we, that would be narrative feature?
But I would like to keep going between the two, because I think that one informs the other and they enrich each other. And so yeah, I definitely feel like, I caught the narrative bug and I kind of loved it, and I want to keep making bigger movies. I think that's really important as well. Like, as a woman in today's kind of culture and everything that's going on around female directors as well, I think to kind of state that ambition boldly and be like, no, I want to make bigger movies.
Good, do it.
Yeah. But at the same time, I love documentaries, and documentary filmmaking is so free and teaches you so much about the world and people and human behavior, and I just think it's such a privilege to be able to do that. So I take each story on its own merits and see what you think. There's a script that I've been reading that I think would be better as a documentary, funnily enough, and like with this project, I thought it was a documentary and then I realized it should be a script. So I think that it just depends on
the story.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Zara.
Well, thank you for having me. It's absolutely been fun.
And for everybody who's at home in their car driving along, are you on social media?
I am. I'm on Twitter.
Okay.
And it, my handle is at Zar, Z-A-R, Hayes, H-A-Y-E-S. Mm-hmm. And same for Instagram as well.
Okay. Well, now you guys know where to find her. And as always, I'm your moderator, Carolina Benetti. You can find me on Twitter at Carolina Benetti and on Instagram at LenaBean113. Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of iTalkMovies.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.